Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Tim Armstrong is the CEO of AOL, and he's going to be the CEO of the combined AOL-Yahoo company once Verizon is done with its merger. But before he joined AOL, he was actually a high-powered executive at Google, and he helped the company grow from about $700,000 in revenue per year to now billions of dollars per quarter. So this also means that Tim Armstrong is one of the few people who actually knows what it's like to be interviewed for a job by Google co-founders Larry Page and Sergey Brin.
You know, they basically said at the beginning of the meeting, after a few questions, they basically said, "We're not really sure what to ask you. Ask yourself the questions. Like, what questions would you ask yourself if you were us?" So I, you know, basically said, "Look, I'm a very direct person, very honest. Here's what I would ask, you know, the following questions." And I thought that was interesting. I realized later after working with them that that wasn't an anomaly. That's one of their tactics.
In this episode of Success, How I Did It, Armstrong shares how he became a high-powered executive and how he leads his teams. He also shares advice that his dad gave him the night before he started at AOL, and advice that he gives his kids and anyone else who wants to become a big-time CEO someday. I'm your host, MBI's U.S. Editor-in-Chief, Allison Chantel. Tim Armstrong is the CEO of AOL, and he'll be the head of the combined AOL-Yahoo company Oath, I believe, when the deal closes. Prior to AOL, he built Google's ad products. He's basically responsible for the brainchild of AdSense, and that he built the ad team from scratch. So we're really happy to have you, Tim.
Allison, good to see you, and thanks for having me on a rainy New York day.
Of course. I appreciate you making the trek. It is not fun out there. So I want to go all the way back to the beginning of your career. Sounds like you were always entrepreneurial. I remember the story about you making a strawberry farm successful or something in your college days.
Yeah, when I was growing up, I always had the entrepreneurial bug, and there were multiple things that I did when I was younger in my kind of middle school, high school age. But one of the things that a lot of people tell the story is there was, with a friend from college, there was a strawberry farm that the bank owned. I don't know if the farmer had lost it to the bank, but there was a strawberry farm, and we went to the bank, and they weren't using the farm. So we said, could we take over the farm for the summer and do a U-Pick strawberry? It'd be a lot less work for us and probably a lot more profitable. And so we did a U-Pick strawberry farm, you know, from a farm we didn't own, and cut a deal with the bank to do it. And we had hundreds of customers drive up and go pick their own strawberries, and it ended up being a very successful venture and a lot of fun.
Yeah, not a bad gig for a college kid.
It was very fun.
Awesome. And so then, so you graduate and you have a short stint in finance, is that right?
Yeah, well, when I graduated from college, I actually taught a program called the Explorer Program at Wellesley College. And then after that, that was for the summer, I went to an investment bank in Boston, and I was there for about 3 or 4 months, and I realized that, you know, banking was not something for me. And so I went to my boss and said, you know, I think you should let me go.
You volunteered to basically be fired?
Yeah, I said, I don't think this is the career for me, and I should do something else. And they said, no, why don't you stay? It seems like, you could do a good job here over time. And I said, I want to go do something else. So I left and ended up starting a newspaper in Boston out of that experience. And that's really what got me, if you look back to the seminal moment for me, what got me into why we're sitting here today. It was really that decision.
Right, yeah, it all seems kind of like building towards, it's no wonder you're the head of a media company basically now. So Bib was the beginnings of Boston newspaper that you started with, and the way you got into that, I guess you had been cold calling executives, just hoping they would talk to you, and nobody would talk to you unless you were a reporter?
Well, I was calling people in Boston. I was really trying to just figure out what I wanted to do and learn about different, you know, careers. And I, again, had thought that banking would be something I'd be really interested in. But when I realized it wasn't, I was like, I should go do research and find out really what I want to do. And so I would call different executives in Boston, CEOs of companies, and see if they would meet with me. And not many of them would. I called one of a very large financial institution in Boston. And the woman was very nice on the phone, the CEO's assistant. And she said, you know, the only people who really cold call here who get through to the CEO are journalists. And so I later that night went back and I was talking to my roommate I was living with. And I said, you know what we should do? We have all our friends in the 20s. Everyone's flopping jobs or figuring out what they want to do. Why don't we start a publication to like go get advice from all of these people and give it to the Boston's filled with young people graduating from all the schools in Boston. So we decided to launch the magazine. The magazine was targeted at exactly my demographic back then. And I didn't know anything about publishing newspapers or magazines, but we basically launched from scratch. We sold everything we owned, cars, bikes, surfboards, the whole thing. We bought a Apple Quadra 650 computer, and we basically learned how to publish from scratch and print from scratch, distribute from scratch. And in that journey, I learned probably the most I've ever learned just about what a business is from start to scratch. And it was a wonderful experience. It was really hard. We did an okay job at it, not great. And we ended up buying a second newspaper, which ended up was a better idea. That was in Cambridge and Harvard Square. So that was the launch of my phone calls to newspaper ownership in a very short time period.
Yeah, well, it sounds like you never had a problem cold calling people, which is like sales 101. Yeah. So it's not really surprising that you ended up having a career in that eventually. But you were telling me a funny story before this about how Casey Affleck used to work. He worked with you.
Yeah, so we bought the second newspaper, which was called The Square Deal. And if you went to Harvard back in those days, you used it. It had coupons in the back. It told you what was happening around town in Cambridge Square. And we hired kids from Harvard to hand them out to other Harvard students. And I was at a dinner a couple of years ago, and Casey Affleck had said to me, hey, do you remember me? You know, do I look familiar? And I said, yeah, of course you're familiar. You know, and I said, you always strike me as very familiar. He said, you don't remember, but I used to work at the Square Deal and hand out the newspapers for you. And I mean, obviously he's done really well, and he's not handing out newspapers anymore for sure. He's won an Academy Award, so. That was a fun story and a good memory back to the old days.
Yeah, not a bad place for him to start. So there you go. So you find that the internet is here, and you go to MIT and you see this kind of presentation, and you kind of switch gears a bit. What happened there?
Yeah, I had another friend of mine owned a store in Boston named Peter Dunn, and he had a store called Cool Beans, which was a Grateful Dead store, and he was very networked in the Cambridge and MIT community, and he said, hey, there's some people coming. They have this new thing called an internet browser, so we're going to meet down at MIT, and you can see it. And I went down, and literally within 1 minute of them turning it on and showing what the browser did, I looked at my friend and said, I'm selling my newspaper as soon as I get back to the office, and I'm going to go do this thing. This is 100 times easier, faster, and more scalable than what we're doing in the newspaper business. And so I literally went back, called my parents on the way home from that meeting, and I said, I'm selling the newspaper. I'm going to try to move to an internet environment. And so we started actually trying to put our newspapers online. This is 1994, I think. And then long story short, I moved pretty quickly. We sold our share in the newspaper back to another publisher in Boston. And then I went off to start doing internet things, which was a lot of fun.
So you rise as this great salesperson within the first internet magazine, I believe. And the company you end up later working for gets acquired by Disney.
Yes.
Right?
So I after the newspaper, I went to go work out. The only thing I found right away at that time, because not many people are doing internet things, was IDG, the big tech publisher, was launching the first internet magazine, which was a magazine about the coming internet. And so I went to work there. In those travels, it's an incredibly long story, but I went to an event with the founders of NASCAR, the France family, and the Frances got up and gave a presentation about where they thought this internet thing was going. I talked to the NASCAR family, and they basically said, look, there's this company, Paul Allen, starting a company on the West Coast called Starwave, which was the
Microsoft's Paul Allen. Right?
Yeah, Microsoft's Paul Allen. And they were the first real content company on the internet. So when I actually got back to Boston from that trip, I had a voicemail on my phone from Starwave. And they said, hey, we heard you're in Boston. We hear you're doing internet things and you're trying to do advertising and content on the internet. We have a company in Seattle. Would you like to come out and visit us? So I flew out to Seattle. Did a day's worth of interviews and got offered the job at the end of the day. And I went back, moved from Boston with a bag of clothes. I didn't own anything else at the time period and moved to Seattle and had an awesome experience out at Starwave. We launched ESPN.com, NFL.com, ABCNews.com, and worked with a whole crew of people from all over the U.S. who had moved there to really get into internet content. And that was an amazing experience. And then Disney bought us. And I ended up moving back to New York to work for Disney, helping them get their internet things off the ground, ESPN and ABC.
So from what I understand, you know, you're pretty young when you go out to Seattle. You're in your mid-20s maybe. And you're working with across platforms, which was a really early concept of TV plus digital plus all these things. And you're also working with the legacy TV sales guys who are like, you know, the old guys who've like worked their way up to the top. Like, how did they let you in? Why were you such a good salesman? Like, what did you figure out?
Well, one is when I was at Starwave in Seattle originally, I had done at the time period the largest deal on the internet that was ever done. So I did a $1 million deal back in like probably 1996 or 1997. And this is when most of the deals were $10,000 deals. So I got on Paul Allen's radar screen. I ended up flying down to the Portland Trailblazers game with Paul Allen and some friends from Starwave. And then when Disney bought the company and I moved to New York, people knew about this deal. The deal I had done was with Rick Scott, who's now the governor of Florida. He was the CEO of Columbia HCA, and he did the first really, truly large ad deal, you know, at Starwave and for ESPN. So when I got to New York, I sort of had a reputation of like somebody who was energetic and was creative and doing deals. So I showed up in New York and I was really one of only a couple internet people there. So it was, I guess it was a little bit more like we were outside the box people who didn't fit into the normal way that everything was happening in New York and media. So they kind of took us everywhere. We were sort of like it was a dog and pony show and we were the dog. And so from that experience, I learned a lot from working at ESPN, which was an amazing company, amazing people, and got to spend a lot of time with people who are super knowledgeable about advertising and super knowledgeable about content. And so I became like their internet buddy.
So that served you well, because then Google came calling. And Google at the time was this tiny startup. It wasn't even top of the search rankings, right? And they were barely generating any revenue, I think. And so Amit Kurdistani, who's now the executive chairman of Twitter, calls you up.
Right.
And he's at Google at the time. What does he say? And what's that meeting like?
So Omid had called and through another woman I worked with at Starwave, actually. And he said, can you meet me in New York City? So I met him at the Carlisle Hotel in New York on a rainy day, actually a rainy Friday. And we basically hit it off right away. If you know Omid, he's one of the best humans on the planet and one of the most engaging. So he at that time, Google was into licensing software. That was the main business model at that standpoint. And they were thinking about getting more into advertising. So Omid asked me a whole bunch of questions about what I thought. And I ended up going out to meet, having breakfast with Sergey out in Palo Alto. And kind of right away, I actually had another job offer at the time from a large gaming company to like at an unbelievable job, actually, which would have, at my age, was like super enticing. But after meeting Omid and Larry and Sergey and some other people from Google, it just, you could tell there was going to be magic there, and it wasn't exactly clear what it was going to be, but decided to join Google, and that was a great decision and a lot of fun and great, just an unbelievable experience, and again, super talented people. It was a super highlight for me.
Do you remember what that first meeting with Larry and Sergey was like? What is it like meeting the Google founders back then as they're growing it?
One of the things, I don't think I've ever told this story, but when we had the first, when I had my first discussion with them, you know, they basically said at the beginning of the meeting, after a few questions, they basically said, we're not really sure what to ask you. Ask yourself the questions. Like, what questions would you ask yourself if you were us? So I, you know, basically said, look, I'm a very direct person, very honest. Here's what I would ask, you know, the following questions. And I thought that was interesting. I realized later after working with them that that's a, that wasn't an anomaly. That's what's one of their tactics. But, you know, they were really driven. I mean, I think to this day, you know, Larry and Sergey are obviously very smart and very creative. They're very competitive also in a good way. And, you know, I'd say they care a lot. I mean, I think at their size now and what they're doing, I'm sure there's a lot of feedback on them and how people feel about them. But they're, at their heart, very good people, both of them.
So when you get to Google, it's generating about $700,000 a year in ad revenue. And now, of course, it's like $25 billion a quarter. And so you really got in there and helped them figure out what ad products were going to work. And one of your brainchilds was AdSense, right? So how did you help develop that? It's now a multi-million, billion-dollar quarter business for them.
Yeah, well, one of the things that that happened at Google, that, first of all, Salar Kamangar, who is the used to be the head of YouTube and was really the brainchild behind AdWords, and a few other people that we worked with, really all it all kind of came together in a very sort of mad scientist way of how AdWords got off the ground and the ad business did. But there were a whole bunch of us working on it, and it had a good outcome on the AdWords side. And then one day, a guy named John Firm, actually, who worked in our ad sales group, came and said, hey, you know, we have a whole bunch of customers that don't have budgets spent on search. They basically load all their budgets in. There's lots of room for other places they could run it, but we can't spend all their money. And by the way, you know, one of our publishers, which was at the time period, I think it was About.com, said, you know, is there any way for you guys to help us figure out how to make more money? And so we literally took a PowerPoint page, mocked up a content page and put AdWords boxes on it that were related to the content. And we took it into the Google meeting, to the executive team meeting, and said, hey, why don't we syndicate all of our ads onto content properties, which today doesn't sound like, you know, brain surgery. But it was a moment in the company's history, I think, where it, like, there were a whole bunch of people who didn't want to do it. They're like, we're a search company. Let's stay focused on search. You know, this doesn't make any sense. You know, ads, display ads don't really work, you know. And so there was a kind of a big argument back and forth. But at the end of the day, we got a group of engineers. We hired Kurt Abrahamson from Jupiter, who was the president of Jupiter, to come and run it. And we spent about a year in my group developing it and growing it. And then we turned it over to Susan Wojcicki, who's running YouTube now. Took it over and ran it, and then there was a Applied Semantics was a company that was bought by the product and engineering team. So that was another product that had a lot of, you know, a lot of founders to it, I guess, and a lot of success because a lot of energy got put into it. And one untold story about Google I should have gone back to is one of the reasons Google was successful in ads is because the search licensing business went away. Yahoo bought Inktomi. And so one of Google's major revenue lines kind of went away because search licensing went to a free model from a paid model. And that allowed a lot of the engineering talent at Google to go focus on ads. And I think without that type of a transition, you know, we never would have had the horsepower in terms of the intellectual capital and engineering and product. And you know, I think sometimes in business you get lucky, and what looked like a bad situation with the licensing business turned out to be an unbelievable big opportunity. And that's really what led to AdWords and AdSense and, you know, the DoubleClick acquisition. There was lots of stuff like that that came out of that. You know, what looked like a tough situation originally turned out to be a boon for the entire company.
So this works. You become like this god within Google, managing this massive department. And then
I was not a god within Google. There were a lot of gods within Google. So there was a massively talented team there.
Well,
unbelievable.
That
talent,
may be
yeah.
true, but still, the head of Time Warner gives you a call, Jeff Bukas. He notices what you've built and what you've done. This is 2009. What made you intrigued to take a meeting with him and to talk about the idea of AOL?
Right. You know, a few things. I would go back to the reason I ended up going to Google was because it looked like there was a huge opportunity in the information about how people got information business, and kind of putting information connected with where commerce happens was a big opportunity. You know, in the 2000s, I had co-founded and funded a company with my college roommate Luke Beatty called Associated Content, which was more of a content company that eventually got sold to Yahoo, actually. But at my time at Google, basically, you know, I'd say after I was there for almost 10 years, I have a personal career philosophy, which is, you know, I think you should do, you should continue to do something as long as you're learning quantum amounts of things in general. And I think the quantum learning is probably the most important attribute to people's careers to continue to grow. And at Google, I wasn't learning anymore, but my interest level over time had started to get really focused in on the content space and where media was going, and working on associated content a little bit. I was on the board for a while, got me interested in where content was going. And then when Jeff Bukas called, it seemed like a unique opportunity. I can go into my investing philosophy, but I'm also somebody who likes to invest. I think. A lot of opportunities are opportunities because everyone can't see them. And if you can read something in the newspaper, it's probably not an opportunity anymore. And AOL was the exact opposite. It was something that everyone had kind of given up on. But they had a lot of resources, a lot of users, and they had a lot of talent. So it seemed like an opportunity if I was going to do something disruptive, there'd also be a big runway to do something disruptive because people, frankly, were counting it out. I think that, you have a choice to go to a startup to start something, or you have a choice to do something at bigger scale. I wanted to do something at bigger scale. And it was just an interesting asset. And, probably going to be a windy path because it was inside of Time Warner. If we wanted to spin it out, we'd have to go through the process of spinning it out, and then we'd have to do all these changes to the company. And it was just a very challenging experience, and that's what I wanted at the time period.
So at the time when you're having this conversation, you're thinking about taking the job, there's a graveyard of AOL CEOs, basically. There was five, I think, within that decade. How do you measure the risk, and how did you decide to jump, and how did you make sure you weren't the sixth in that graveyard?
Yeah, it's interesting. I didn't want to take the job if I didn't think I can do it, and I definitely had a lot of reflection time on that because the same thing. A lot of these companies that have these situations have a lot of CEOs, and they're all smart people. Like they're good at their careers. So I was kind of carefully thinking about it, but on the other hand, I thought, what if this totally fails and it's the world's biggest failure? Really, who cares? Like, I'll probably learn more doing it. And I think a lot of people said to me, why would you ever leave Google? Why would you leave Google and your reputation at Google to go to do something like AOL? But I kind of thought about it the opposite, which was, if you wanted to have the most intense learning experience and apply a lot of the skills I had learned in the 10 or 15 years prior, AOL seemed like a great opportunity to do that. My personality is more entrepreneurial and it just seemed like an opportunity that, although it had tons of risk, it also had tons of opportunity, and you had to be willing. Like my dad said to me the night before I started, he said, this is a burn the bridge moment. If you fail at this, you can't walk backwards. So you should figure out how to always look forward. And I think that was a great piece of advice because that's essentially what we had to do over and over and over again.
And how do you make a burn the bridge type decision? Like, how do you know you're making the right choice, especially as the leader of a huge company?
Yeah, I think, one thing is I went around, like when I took the AOL job, I had known a lot of CEOs before that, but I also traveled around to meet. I went on a little mini kind of leadership roadshow before I actually started. I got announced that I was going to start, and then I had like some time before I actually started. And I spent a lot of time with a lot of different leaders who I respected, who are big leaders across corporate America, and some entrepreneurs. And, essentially, I think your CEO job, you basically have to be okay with risk, and you have to be okay with failure. As long as you're going, there's a saying, which is you have to fail towards a goal. Like, as long as you're failing, if you know what the goal is, it's okay to fail in that direction. And that's kind of the advice I got from people. And I think on that roadshow, I had a lot of people challenge me. Like, the best mentors I had are also the most challenging people. And on that roadshow, they asked me a lot of the questions I ended up facing, further on. And I wasn't prepared for all of them, but I kind of knew what the role was and what the job was going to be. And fortunately or unfortunately for AOL, a lot of that I learned on the job overall. So it was challenging.
And when you come into a new job like that, do you need to bring your own team with you? Because that's something you did. You kind of cleared out house a little bit with the executive ranks, brought in some people from Google. Was that essential?
When I first started, I brought a couple of people in. Maureen Sullivan, who's kind of president of Rent the Runway now, was the first person who came over from Google with me. And you know, what I told the AOL team was, look, this is the team. Like, everyone's going to have their shot. You know, we have to change what we're doing. Some of the changes, if you want to roll with them and stick with them, great. If this is not what you want to do, you know, raise your hand, because we're going to go in a different direction. And I think over time, I did end up bringing a bunch of people in from Google and other people as well. I would say, looking back on it overall, you had a very challenged company. We were doing very, just out of the gates, trying to spin a company out of a public company and take it public alone is a massive challenge. Forget about one that's in a downturn overall. So I think there was a whole group of us that were basically somewhat experienced, but not fully experienced in doing all the things that we were doing. So we were figuring out on the fly. And I'd say, I bet if you went back and talked to a lot of those people, it was probably one of the best experience, hardest, but bet most learning experience overall. But if I went back to it now, I probably at my experience level would do the same thing. If I were doing it again now, I would probably, you know, take a step back and take a better account of my own skills of what I was really good at and not good at. And I probably would have augmented the team slightly. Not that I wouldn't have brought the people in from Google, but I would have had a couple other people around me who had more experience. And, you know, I think that was a lesson and something I'm frankly taking into the Yahoo deal we're working on, you know, now.
And so you also had a really tough challenge of, this was kind of an uninspired company. They had gone through a couple of rough years, maybe didn't even remember quite what a good year felt like. And you have to come in and kind of get people to buy into your vision and get people excited again. So how do you go in and breathe some inspiration into a company that feels deflated?
Yeah. So one is we did a 100-day process. And what I did was I traveled around the whole globe. There were about 10,000 employees at the time. I saw about 9,000 in person. And I had three processes I was running: feedback from the entire company and team, feedback from the management team, and then a list I was keeping of things that I thought we should be doing. And after the 100 days, we did a meeting at the Time Warner Center, and I put up three whiteboards. On one whiteboard, I wrote back the results from the entire global team of what they think we should invest in. I put up a whiteboard of what the management team thought, and I put up a whiteboard of what I thought, and I flipped them all around at the same time, and each one had five things on them. All of the whiteboards were identical except for one area on the whiteboard that I had flipped around on my personal side. So the whole company was already kind of in alignment, and I think that got people excited. They weren't told what the strategy was. You know, they got input into it, and everyone was kind of on the same pathway and believing in it.
And so down the road, Lowell McAdam and you have a conversation, and Lowell is, of course, the CEO of Verizon, and Verizon ends up buying AOL for $4.4 billion. How did that conversation start, and how do you decide as a head of a huge company in AOL that this is the right move?
Yeah, there was two things quickly. Lowell is an incredible CEO at Verizon, and you know, somebody who really helped grow that wireless, took it from wireline to wireless, and became one of the most successful companies on the planet in doing so. When I sat down with Lowell, it was one-on-one. It was at the Allen & Company conference, at what they call the Duck Pond, where people kind of have meetings after the conference is over. And essentially, I had a blank sheet of paper, and Lowell asked me a number of questions, just where the industry is going, what the structure was, what I thought was happening. And I basically drew him a diagram of what I thought was happening. And we had, you know, talked for an hour or two about it. And then I didn't see him for, you know, months afterwards. And then he called. We had talked about, like, maybe there's operational things to do together between the companies. And then he called and came back in the fall and met with him. And we had more and more conversations. So over the course of time, there was like a sort of very natural progression of like where things were going. On the AOL front, what was happening at the same time period was, you know, everything was going mobile and everything was going data-driven overall. And so I used to carry around a five-column chart from our board of directors meetings that I started every meeting with, that basically had the strategic priorities for the company. And mobile, video, and data were the first three things on that chart. And I knew we needed to solve that, you know, issue. And Verizon at the same time wanted to solve their challenge of how do they grow services. So what naturally kind of grew out of that conversation was a combination of what Verizon needed to solve and what we needed to solve. And it didn't start out as an M&A deal. It started out as a big operational deal. Then it went to a joint venture. Then it went to a full company sale. But that's essentially how it started. And you know, at the same time period, there were other companies kind of kicking the tires on AOL, and we were meeting with people. But the reality was, Verizon, if you think the future is mobile, then it's going to be about video and data. you know, hard to argue Verizon wasn't a great outcome for us as a business. And it's been, I've been there for 2 years now. It's been a great experience.
So one thing that's happening in the broader media landscape and digital in general is this term duopoly. A lot of media executives keep talking about it. It's Google and Facebook taking a ginormous share of digital ad dollars. I think there's a study that came out from IAB where it looked like 89% of the digital money was going there and 11% was for everybody else like AOL or Business Insider. So how do you look at this landscape and what AOL's role can be and just where is everything going in your opinion?
Sure. So first, I think you got to add Amazon into that list. And so I, the people who are saying, people are saying duopoly are missing one of the legs of the stool. I think Amazon's a real competitor in the space. I'd say I'm probably a contrarian thinker on this. I like the fact that Google and Facebook are getting more successful and getting bigger at what they're doing because, frankly, for us, we have a different strategy. So the stronger they get at what they're doing, I think it's going to be harder for them to adjust at a big scale to some of the things that we're thinking about doing. So it's, you know, we're a big publisher. We're one of the largest publishers on the web with our content, and we're one of the larger ad players. So it's challenging. And but you have a choice. I'll give you the choice. You have a choice to be in an industry that's growing at 15, 20, 30% globally. The internet's going to double in the next 5 years in terms of people that are connecting to it through mobile. Only 15% of commerce by 2020 is going to be on the internet. There's huge opportunity in front of us. So you have a choice as a leader and as a company. You can go compete in linear spaces or offline spaces that are really challenged, or you can go into a space that's growing and you compete against gold medal Olympic athletes. You know, tough to say Google and Facebook aren't executing at the top of their game. Same thing with Amazon. But that sets an awesome bar for us as a company to kind of compete at that level. And it challenges us creatively to try to get in that game. So I think from where we sit right now, I choose the tailwind industry that's growing. And I would choose to have Olympic gold medal competitors because it's only going to raise our game. And I think with industry, I have a whole viewpoint on industry consolidation, but I think, you know, where the world's going, we're heading to a place where there's going to be giant scale we've never seen before globally. There's going to be a set of companies that have the capabilities to do that, and those companies are going to really, really have the chances to build companies the size that the world hasn't seen before.
Okay, well, for a final question, you've had to make a lot of hard decisions as a leader of many companies at this point. But you're also really personable and a likable guy. Like, how do you strike that balance between gaining respect from your employees, making the hard choices, and being liked and respected as a manager?
Yeah, I think two things. I think it was advice I got when I was growing up, and I give to my own kids, which is to thy own self be true. What you see is what you get. If you interact with me, this is who I am, love me or hate me. And I think being authentic is important. The second thing is the mentor crew I have. I have a bunch of advice I always give to younger people, but one of them is to build your personal entourage or board of directors. And I have 5 or 8 people outside the company I rely on. All of them, basically, I have one person, David Bell, used to be the CEO of IPG. He's in our office almost every day. I meet with him every Friday. And every Friday, he basically starts by telling me everything I'm doing wrong overall. And it's probably, for me, it's the most helpful meeting of the week because it always resets me back to, okay, what am I supposed to be doing as a leader? What's my job? What are those things? So I think that, you know, if you're yourself and you're authentic and you're honest and direct, the other thing I've learned from David and people like Howard Schultz and Ken Chenault and other people like that who have mentored me over the time is just be direct with people. I did an all-company meeting with AOL and Yahoo yesterday. You know, I got asked if there's going to be impacts from doing the deal. You know, I said, yes, there are. That's what happens when two companies come together. I'm not going to beat around the bush. We're going to try to do the least amount we possibly can. But the bottom line is that's part of what's happening with the deal, and I want to be direct about it. So that directness, I think, helps a lot. Also, I'm being honest with yourself.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Tim. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Allison. Good to see you.
You too. Thanks for listening to Success, How I Did It. For more episodes, subscribe on Acast or iTunes. You can also check out more interviews that we've done with the founders of Tinder, Bleacher Report, Warby Parker, and more.